Chinook, it's a warm wind.
It's a changing wind.
Chinook, a program for and about Alaskan natives.
Chinook Echoes is looking back into Native heritage.
How things are and how they got that way.
Chinook Patterns is information.
Issues that affect the patterns of Alaskan life.
Chinook Profiles, portraits of people, places, events.
But mostly the people who are Alaskan.
Welcome to Chinook Profiles. I'm Paula Schiller, back again with Ginny Alexander of the Fort Yukon Museum. She's been taking us on a tour of the displays, most of them showing various aspects of Kuchin Athabascan art and lifeways. We've wandered over to an area where there's a birch bark canoe, and Ginny's about to explain some red coloring on a bow that's been strung with sinew.
The color originally came from a red ochre stone, and is what the people do is they take this stone and they shave it in or make it into a powder and mix it with water, and then you get this red color, and a lot of their artifacts are painted this color. Then the white man came along with his medicines, and one of the things he brought was iodine, and so they used that for a while for dyeing their artifacts. And then it became popular to use the red crepe paper, you know how it bleeds when it gets wet. And then the latest is red marking pin, but it's still the red color. I asked somebody, why red color? And they said, probably because it's easier to spot. You know, if you lay it down in the woods or something, you can see it right away when you pick it up. Over here we have the type of canoe that the people today make. In fact, this canoe here was made by the 6th grade bilingual class a few years ago, and it's made out of canvas, but it's pretty much the same style as the other canoe. And they're very lightweight, and people use them when they go muskrat trapping or to check fish nets and whatnot. This is a fish net here, made by old man Jacob Flitt, and this particular size would be used for king salmon. This little tool here is used as a mesh measure. It's just a little piece of wood, and you want to make sure all the holes in your fishnet are the same size or it doesn't hang right and you can't catch any fish, so you use a mesh measure. Now, if you're a real pro, you can use your hand, and that's how Jacob does his. Then we have something that's not seen very often anymore. This was made by Leah Roberts. It's a fish skin bag, and it's made from salmon skin, several salmon skins sewn together, and then the bottom and the top are moose hide, and it would be used to pack around your dry fish. Another method of fishing, you don't use this on the Yukon, but on a clear river such as the Porcupine, is the fish spear. Now this one has nails on the end, but this, in the old days, this would have been made out of caribou antler. And then this part here is
a tine of a fork.
Yeah, that's what it looks like. It is made out of bone, and then it's all bound on with babiche, which is rawhide. And is what you do is you stand and you look for you through the water on a clear river, and this is why you can't use the Yukon, it's too muddy. And when you see a fish, you just shoot the spear down and jab him, and these two bones here kind of spring apart, and then you've got your fish. Another method of fishing.
Very good.
Another method of fishing is the dip net, and it's just a big net that's closed at the bottom, and you just scoop the fish out. The older people say that there used to be so many fish in the river that the river actually rose with the number of fish in it, and you could just scoop them out, and that's what this dip net's for. Then, of course, the most effective method of catching fish is the fish wheel. Now, this was not invented by the people here, but was brought up by the white miners at the turn of the century. And is what it is, essentially, is a perpetual motion machine. And the current comes along, and it pushes the wheels, and you'll sometimes see paddles here. And as the wheel turns, the basket scoops up the fish because they're swimming upstream. And as it turns further, the fish fall into this little trough here. And when it reaches its apex, they slide down the trough and into the box, and you come and pick them up out of the box. Now, I understand that the record catch for a fish wheel is 10,000 fish in one 24-hour period. I'm glad I didn't have to clean them. This is our exhibit on the Hudson's Bay Company. Alexander Hunter Murray, the Hudson's Bay Company, came to Fort Yukon in 1847 to establish a trading post here. And he knew he was on what was then considered Russian territory, so he built a fort as protection against the Russians. He wasn't afraid of the Indians, but he was afraid that he was going to be attacked by the Russians. Well, the Russians sent over three guys to check him out, and they came in, and one acted like he'd been outcast from the Russian post, and and begged to come in, and so Murray let him in, and this guy was a spy, and he looked around and decided Murray wasn't really worth bothering about, so he went back and reported that. And so the Russians never did bother Murray, and they never did come this far into the interior. But Murray really was afraid of them.
Is that what Fort Yukon is all about, then? Is that a Hudson Bay fort?
It was a Hudson Bay trading post. Mm-hmm. And it was never a military post, but they did have the fort for protection against the Russians. In 1867, the United States bought Alaska from Russia, but Murray didn't want to move out. So his company said, well, just stay there until somebody kicks you out. So he stayed here for 2 years. And then the Alaska Commercial Company, which is still the same company, although they've changed names a number of times, wanted to take over trading here. So in 1869, the United States Army sent up Captain Raymond, and there was a solar eclipse, and he determined that Fort Yukon was indeed in Alaska, which everybody already knew. And he kicked the Hudson Bay Company out, and they moved to Old Rampart right on the Canadian border. And actually, they didn't move quite far enough, and he kicked them out of there, and they had to move about like 12 miles further. But so the Alaska Commercial Company took over trade in 1869, and they've been here ever since.
I didn't realize there was a Hudson Bay post this far.
It's the farthest west. I think also maybe possibly the farthest north also. I'm not sure. And then this is a map of the 1949 trap lines of the people, and this is the thing that shows where they are. Much of the trap lines are still owned by the same people. The one thing that was important about this is that during the land claim settlement, where if you claimed that you had been using, such and such a land, you had to prove it in some way, and a lot of these old trapping cabins and whatnot were there and could be used as proof that your family had indeed used that land. And then we have some skulls from the various animals from here, the timber wolf and the lynx and fox and otter, and this one is rabbit and muskrat, and that was a black bear, and he was delicious when we ate him. Then we have what many anthropologists consider the height of the Athabascan technology, and that's the snowshoe, and this brings us into our wintertime activities of the Gwich'in. The snowshoes are birch with upturned overlapping toes, and the webbing on them is made from babiche, and no one has improved on these. The government's tried a lot of different kinds of plastics and whatnot, but at 70 below, plastic just doesn't go up here. But the babiche does not shatter. There's two kinds of babiche. This, the one in the upper section and the two lower sections, is a very, very thin babiche. The babiche in the center section is a much wider babiche, which is the way they usually make it. And you have to go in a certain direction. And it's the men quite often or generally make the frames, and the women generally do the webbing, although it's not a hard and fast rule that it has to be so, but that's generally the way it's done. Then we have a dog pack. Before the coming of the white men, the Gwich'in used the dogs as a pack animal, and this particular pack here is made out of caribou legging. The fur comes from the leg part of the caribou, and they always make the dog pack rope the same, and is what it is. It's the ends on a piece of white skin, caribou skin. It's the outside edge that's irregular, and is what they do is braid these pieces together into a rope for a dog pack rope, and it's kind of like, I guess, our rag rugs, where you can't use them for anything else, so you might as well braid them together and make a rug. And I think that's kind of what this rope is like. These are dog booties, and during certain times of the year, it tends to ice up, like if you in the springtime when it melts during the day, and then in the evening it gets frozen again, and it's very hard on dogs' feet. So they make little booties for them. They actually look just like what little kids wear, and they're made out of canvas with moose hide bottom, and they're lined. Ooh. And but you have to protect your dog's feet because they were very important in travel. And they used to also make very fancy harnesses with all sorts of braids and bells and beads and whatnot. I've never seen one. I've just heard about them. But this is the kind of bell that they use. Somebody found this one. It's all deteriorated, but they must have really been something. Some people say that the bells were just for design. Other people said that it scared away evil spirits. Other people said that it was just, to let everybody know you were coming. And so whatever the reason, they did decorate them up quite fancy, and they used bells quite a bit. Over here we have a sled. Dog racing was introduced by the white miners also. And using dogs as a pulling animal was introduced by the white miners. Before that time, the women used to pull the toboggans. And in fact, the women did everything, it seems like, in Gwich'in society except for hunt and fight, which were the men's jobs. But the women pulled the toboggans, they set up the camps, they packed around the tents, and they took care of the kids, and they would run rabbit snare lines, and if the fellow shot a moose, he'd say, "Hey, honey, it's over there," and she'd go take her toboggan and drag the moose back and butcher it, and then she'd cook. And the men always ate first, because it's kind of like the captains on the ship or the pilots on airplanes. They always get the first food and the best food, because they're essential to survival. And so was the hunter in the Gwich'in society. He was essential to survival. Anyway, this sled's kind of small because it was made by the fourth grade bilingual class several years ago. Unfortunately, we have bilingual in this town. I wouldn't have anything in the museum. No, but they did a pretty good job. And it would be used for racing. The terms, the G and the Ha, that dog mushers use, come from what mule team drivers used to give the mule teams. The term mushing comes from the French word for march. And this is, in here we have a couple of the caribou legging bags. And this one is just plain. This one's been scraped off. And these are lightweight, they're flexible, they're practically waterproof, and they would use it to store dry meat and dry fat and whatnot. That's what they packed it around with. And on the back you can see a beaded sled bag. Here.
Wow.
It's real pretty. Not in a very good place to see right now. But then back here in the back room, we have some things on the caribou. The caribou were to the Gwich'in much as the buffalo were to the Plains Indians, insofar as they used them for everything, and they used all of them. When it's like that, it's just a plain caribou skin. It's used as ground covering when people go out camping, and almost everybody, now, well, that's a little generalized, but quite a few people still use them. And if you wanted one, you wouldn't have too much trouble borrowing one. But they're very warm, and caribou hair is hollow and is probably about the best insulation known to man. All the clothing in the old days used to be made out of caribou. And there's a white, well, this is a skin that's used in it. This is a step in the tanning process. All the hair's been scraped off, and all the meat's been scraped off. And now this skin, if it were wet, we could take this scraper here. It's made from the leg bone of a caribou, and it's been split in half. And what you do is you hold it like so and just scrape all that black stuff off. And then when you get all that black stuff scraped off, then you can go ahead and make your babiche like this.
Just slicing thin.
Yeah, very thin, and that's a real art, I'll tell you. Not too many people know how to make babiche good, but you have to cut it very, very thin and very even, and it's a real trick. Or you can go ahead and finish tanning it, and you do that by using the moose brains. So you put you let them rot, and then you put the skin into the moose brains, and you do this away from the house because it smells something fierce. And you soak it, and then you scrape it with using this type of a scraper there. You see, it still has that joint on it. Gives you a little added weight. And then you scrape it with that, and that's all you do is scrape it and scrape it and scrape it and scrape it. And then eventually, if you do everything right, it'll come out nice and white and soft like that. Now, you can either use it like that, or you can go ahead and put that over a tripod. I don't know if you saw our tripod out there. And you put it over there, and you put some rotten cottonwood underneath, and you smoke it, and that's how you get the brown color, if that's what you want. And some people do. The tendons, or the sinew in the caribou, was used as thread in the old days, and the brains were used in the tanning process. The membrane around the heart was used to store grease. Even the toe bones were used for a game that the people used to play. They would take the toe bones and kind of file them down a little bit, and then they would attach that to a string. They'd slip a string through all of them, and on one end of the string is tied that piece of leather that you see there that's full of holes. And then on the other end of the string is attached a stick. This one's too short. It should be longer. It should be about, maybe 8 or 10 inches long. And again, you swing it up, and you try to put that pointed stick through as many of those toe bones as you can and as many holes on the hide as you can. And you get points according to how you score it. Then we have the arrow point there, which is made from caribou antler, and then we have an awl that's also made from caribou antler, and the next awl is made from a bone, caribou bone, and that knife there is made from the rib bone of a caribou. And they used the whole thing. Nothing on a caribou was wasted. And that's about it.
Oh, thank you, Ginny Alexander, for this series of programs recorded at the Fort Yukon Museum. I'm Paula Schiller. And you've been listening to Chinook, a production of KUAC-FM at the University of Alaska in Fairbanks.
Chinook, it's a warm wind.
It's a changing wind.
Chinook, a program for and about Alaska Natives.
Chinook Echoes is looking back into Native heritage.
How things are and how they got that way.
Chinook Patterns is information.
Issues that affect the patterns of Alaskan life.
Chinook Profiles, portraits of people, places, events.
But mostly the people who are Alaskan.
Welcome to Chinook. I'm Paula Schiller. For 2 days in February, the Fairbanks Inn was turned over to a confabulation of Alaskan Native artists. The Institute of Alaska Native Arts invited working artists and a few experts in related fields to talk to each other. There were more artists than administrators and more Natives than whites. The kind of information shared was personal, inspirational, and intended to be useful to the artists and anyone who would like to know more about making art in Alaska. Leading off a discussion on being an Alaska Native artist was Jim Schopert, sculptor, printmaker, and president of the Traditional Arts Panel of the State Council on the Arts.
I've not always been an artist. It's only been in recent years that I actually began practicing or producing art objects. Prior to that time, it was I wasn't much of anything, just someone who was enjoying life like many other people do. For me, art began, the actual production of art began February 26, 1973 in Anchorage, sometime in the afternoon. I know the specific date because prior to that time I had never created anything in my life, but I had spent 25 years thinking about it. And I'm just a little bit into the second 25 years, and I'm happy to say that I'm very pleased personally with the direction that it's going in. But when I did art, I didn't know very much about art. I was producing things I didn't know the content of. I didn't know the ramifications of what an art object was. So I began studying art in a formal Western tradition in the University of Alaska at Anchorage. And as I was studying this, along with it was developing within myself a greater need to pursue and understand more fully the native cultures of Alaska, not just my own particular Tlingit background, but the native cultures of all of Alaska. I was fortunate in that period of time in 73 to work with the Cook Inlet Native Association in a position that took me into many of the rural areas, the bush areas of Alaska, and met many of the practicing traditional ivory carvers and basket makers and so forth, and was profoundly impressed with that aspect of Native art, as opposed to the type of work that you'll see in a gallery in any city. There was a difference. I didn't quite know what the difference was. I didn't know how to define it. At that time, there was an Eskimo dance group working in Anchorage called Urban Natives United. And I was invited to come to one of their little potlucks. They had a monthly dance in Anchorage in the basement of the Pioneer Schoolhouse, which is a very small room, about one quarter the size of this one. And the Urban Natives United dance group was there. They practice, I think, once every 2 weeks or once a month. And everybody brought food together, and it was a very intimate, close relationship that was developed in that little room when they danced. I had never before experienced this sort of element of Native culture, Native identity. But it was in that small room when the drums, when they started hitting the drums and started singing the songs and the dancers began to perform, that there was a definite feeling that rose from the people and filled that room. This was something that profoundly impressed me and still stays with me now. What was that feeling? There was a spirit generated in that, a simple performance. If it was seen in non-Western context, I don't think it would maybe be seen in the same majesty, but in that small room, it was undeniable, the power of Alaska's native culture being expressed very completely. That is that spiritual essence within the practicing Native cultural art forms that sets it apart, for me anyway, as I look, being a Native artist, what does Native art mean? There's an essence in it. There's content to the work, be it performing, literary, visual art, what have you, that goes beyond just merely the Western concept of art. It's something I'm still trying to fully document and understand within myself what it is, but I'm gaining a better idea and better understanding of what it is. I am an Alaskan Native artist. For some reason, I don't know why, I'm an artist, but there seems to be a distinction between the two, Alaskan Native artist and artist. And given the task to think about this a little bit and how it relates to me, I've come to a few insights into it. We're not much different from artists, any artist that produces any object or performs or writes any material in the world. We have the same fundamental understanding of what art is, that as artists we are pursuing basic aesthetics. We want to excel. We want to produce an image that is as good as our intentions and capabilities can possibly make it. We work with beauty, and we want this beauty to be expressed as good as we can. This doesn't differ from other artists. Another one that's less glamorous is the fact that as artists, we're concerned with business. Art is a business. If we're going to be successful, we have to maintain it in a very business-like way. Otherwise, it doesn't succeed very well. We have to motivate ourselves, if we're going to be a producing artist, to produce more than just what is our own fancy. We have to produce enough to support ourselves. And when we get into that area, it's no different from any other artist any place else in the world. We produce the body of work. We document it. We sell the stuff. We inventory it. We ship it. We trade it. We insure it. And we take responsibility for the object because it eventually comes back to us that this was something that we had produced. But where the differences arise between my understanding, my viewpoint of what Alaskan Native artist is and artist, where the differences come in, it seems to me, when we produce an object, in a Western sense, we can hang it on a wall or sit it on a pedestal or do something with it and never have to really explain it because it is art for art's sake. What meets the eye is exactly what you're getting. There doesn't have to be a deep philosophical or any sort of a cultural context to the work if it's done in a Western sense. However, where the difference lies is when a simple question is posed to the Alaska Native artist, what does this mean? What is this thing that you created? Explain it to me. Then we are automatically put into the position of being the educator. We have to paint the picture to allow the view to that person who asked the question, allowing them into our culture, a greater understanding of it. Because when the Alaskan Native artist creates something, he's creating something not just from his own imagination, but something from a very long series of centuries of cultural development. And to understand the piece means you have to take the time to understand the culture from which it came, some aspect of the culture. That makes it unique. We're good artists, but we're not very good educators. We aren't trained as educators, but yet we're put into the role for some reason to try to educate the people about what Native art is. It just happens to be the time in which we live. Perhaps sometime, not too far away, there'll be developed within the Native community educators to take that burden away from the Native artist. Another aspect that seems to differ a little bit with the Native artist, another role that I perceive that many Native artists are put into, consciously or unconsciously, is having to document, to explain changes and transitions and developments within individuals or groups of Native artists. That puts us into a category of being an art historian. Now in Alaska, this is understandably a very small community. There are only two trained art historians, both of which I don't know if they've done adequate service to the Native art forms. But there is a tremendous need right there is to get the Native art historian or get an art historian who understands and can penetrate the depth of Native cultures and draw from it the understandings to develop that documentation which will serve as a foundation of understanding more fully and raising more completely to appreciation the Alaska Native art forms. As it is now, it doesn't exist. We may be good artists, but we're not very good art historians. And as a result, what we know about the art of Native Alaskans is what we read in the newspaper articles or magazines. It's a hit or miss situation. It's not documented. It's very scattered. Another concern, a very obvious one, and we use materials that aren't available to anyone who's not of Alaska Native ancestry. Access to these materials are a little bit hindered because of the development of the language of the law. There are subsistence clauses in there that say that we can use the ivory and the baleen and the spruce root and other materials on the Alaskan lands that were culturally part of our heritage. But it, as time goes on, it becomes increasingly more difficult to use it. That's something that has to be dealt with very sincerely, is that legal aspect of it. We are better educators and art historians than we are lawyers. These things, to my mind, indicate a change between an Alaskan Native artist and an artist. But there's another one that seems to be a little bit closer to home. Anaslahash Dawyeth Weha was my great-grandfather. They came from Teslin, lived in Taku for many, many years. There's been four generations between him and myself. And of these four generations, many, many changes has taken place between what I consider the representative of traditional Tlingit value and what we have today, which is much, much different. My great-grandfather represents the intact traditional value of the Tlingit culture, because then contact was just being made with the non-Tlingit cultures. I look at myself as merely a fragment of that culture. I don't carry very much of it with me. I carry merely fragments of it. And when I think of the Native artist in Alaska, I can't help but think that some more than others, but yes, we're all merely carrying fragments with us. There's just can't be the entire intact cultural perspective. It's altered too much. But nonetheless, because we carry aspects of our heritage with us, it puts us into the context of we are the ones that are going to carry our culture with us. We are the culture bearers of Alaskan heritage, Alaskan cultural heritage. There is no one else. There can never be somebody coming into us, into the Native community, and saying, this is how the Native cultures existed 150 years ago or 200 years ago, and here's how they exist now. That can't be the identity, the definition, and the understanding of that cultural reality is within us. We are the ones that have to define it. We are the ones that have to understand it, and we are the ones that have to promote it. We have to share this understanding with other people. So perhaps the most, when I think of what it means to be an Alaska Native artist, I think more than anything else, more than being the lousy educator and the hit or miss art historian and the just the dreadful lawyer, is more important is to, our responsibility is to explain as fully and completely as we can possibly do through, if nothing else, the work that we produce or the poem that we write or the book that we write or the song or the dance that we perform, as much integrity and as much impact and insight within our cultures as we can possibly do. That is our responsibility. No one can develop that within ourselves except us. Thank you.
Jim Schopert, Tlingit, artist and participant at the Institute of Alaska Native Arts' first confabulation. I'm Paula Schiller, and this has been a production of KUAC-FM at the University of Alaska in Fairbanks.